is the Day Zero Update for August 23rd, 2015. I'm Filippo D'Onofrio.
I'm Patrick Mifflin.
I'm Brandon Perkins.
And I'm Lee Lamb.
And guys, apparently the big news this week is that Madden is coming out, but I don't think anybody else cares about that.
Yeah, we don't give a shit.
No.
You know you're all about that Madden, Phil.
Nah, I could care less. The only thing that's significant about Madden is it's usually the floodgate opener for the holiday release season. So in that sense, I'm kind of excited because now we're actually going to start getting all the good games.
So and it's going to happen fast this year, dude.
Yeah, it's going to happen fast. And, you know, I think pretty much the same day as Madden, we're also getting Grandia 2. So that's what we're really good about. Yeah.
Remember, folks, Phil is a Canadian, so he doesn't really give a crap about football.
What's my excuse?
Utah's close enough to Canada.
Yeah.
I wish.
So there's that. But, yeah, did want to mention that at least because a lot of us have been looking forward to the re-release of Grandia 2, and now that's actually happening, and we'll be able to download it and just lose countless hours in it. So, yeah.
Or approximately 30 of them, take your pick.
Yeah.
It's a great game, but it is definitely the shortest of the Grandia games, unless you really, really get into looking like get to the side quests and things.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So there's that. But besides that, what have you guys been playing this week?
I'm still on Ultra Street Fighter 4. There's definitely some forward motion in getting the local fighting game community, I think I said on the show, up and running. And so I'm trying to get my just knock the rust off of my skills. And get to a point where I can really compete with whoever might show up at the first events that'll probably start happening next month. On top of that, I've been back in Final Fantasy 14 just because, I'm still in the Heaven's Ward content now. Just hanging at level 55, halfway from 55 from 50 to 60, and it's fantastic. I'm enjoying every minute of it.
Yeah, it's definitely an MMO where a lot of people love it.
Yeah, I've said this before on the show. It's really the game I wish WoW had been. It does a lot of the things that WoW does, but I don't know. Maybe the simple fact that it's Final Fantasy helps, but at the same time, I didn't feel that way about 11.
Yeah. It took you enough to spend, I don't know how many hours playing it. So
yeah,
you know,
and that was something that like. I don't even feel I got that heavily into it. It was just a time sink for me. But Final Fantasy 14 is definitely a legit addiction at this point.
Yeah. Where's that?
How about you?
Well, as usual, I've been playing Rare Replay because there's just so many good games on there. I'm a little bit annoyed that I finished the Battletoads arcade game with all three characters and didn't get the achievement for it, so... Thanks, Rare. I'll just have to finish it again.
Hopefully it works this time.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I'm not too upset about it because I still have, you know, a bunch of other stuff to go do in it. And all of it. And the Battletoads arcade game is just a lot of fun anyway, so I'm not too mad. There's that. And I've also been playing Volume, which is the new one from Bithel Games. Guys aren't familiar, he's the Mike Bithell is the guy behind Thomas Was Alone, which I was a huge fan of, and this is kind of different for him. This is more like if you remember Metal Gear Solid, the VR missions.
Of a stripped down stealth game.
Yeah, stripped down stealth game. This one's not quite as stripped down as VR missions was. This one basically takes the VR missions concept. But you have all the cool gadgets and moves and stuff. It's basically MGS distilled to its core components, and it just works super well.
Is it top down?
Yeah, it's top down. Ooh. Yeah, it's what MGS was before it got stupid. Yes, I said it. MGS is stupid. Send hate mail too.
That's cold.
Ooh. Apparently.
Whoa.
Sorry about it.
Our connection just got bad.
Yeah. No,
look at that. Sitting here talking all that mess, and then, you know, the internet decides to try and take us out.
Yeah, it's like, nope. Nope, you will not say bad things about Metal Gear Solid.
See? Look at that.
Okay. So,
yeah. Kojima is in the Matrix.
Or somebody from, you know, whatever is left of Konami is. We have to get Brandon back here. Well, I was trying to recall him.
That reminds me of another story.
Right, I'm
that
back.
I've...
Oh, okay. Welcome back, Brandon. Right. So apparently Comcast doesn't like us talking smack about.
Well, can you guys tell me if love can bloom on the battlefield?
I don't know. Don't wanna. Yeah, what I do know is that I really love volume, and it has a level editor, so it's going to have a heck of a lot of legs, this game. Yeah, and that's pretty much how volume is. So, Lee, Brandon?
Well, I'm good.
Much like Phil, I've been playing a lot of Rare Replay. Recently got back. I started playing Banjo-Kazooie again, and you know, for how old that game is, I'm surprised just how quickly it sucked me back in.
Yeah, it still holds up. I mean, it was probably some of the best platform game design that's ever been made, you know.
Yeah. And what's particularly surprising is the fact that even though the graphics by today's standards are really blocky, they still look really good.
Yeah, mm-hmm. That says a lot because a lot of those old N64 games did not age well.
No.
No, they did not.
Yeah. And this, well, these, Banjo-Kazooie, Banjo-Tooie, those are, kind of updated for the Xbox 360. So.
Oh, they're the Xbox Live Arcade remakes?
Yeah. Those are the ones.
That makes sense.
They're still blocky as hell, but, know.
Yeah, they kind of smoothed out.
Yeah, the textures.
Well, they're not really remakes. They just went back and smoothed up. They smoothed out the graphics a little bit, so it's not as blurry.
Yeah,
still looks really good though.
Yeah,
and it's reminds you why Rare was great at one point.
Yeah, and could potentially be again. We'll see how Sea of Thieves comes out.
I mean, from what they've shown, for the little it's shown, it looks like it's definitely got potential.
Yep.
Yeah. And when you see a project like this in particular, it really sends the message that the studio behind it is in a state of soul searching.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, it, on top of the games themselves, the behind the scenes material that they provide, and they provide a lot of it, is also quite engaging. You know, they'll show you, you know, they got interviews about, you know, when they were designing the game, concept, materials, artwork, music.
Yeah.
They got a couple of stuff on some projects that didn't get realized that after looking at some of them, I kind of wish they did because they look very interesting.
Yeah. Yeah, I think they might have thrown some of those in there as kind of a, you know, kind of a barometer to see what people's reactions to them would be, and maybe they'll pick those up at some point. You know, you never know. But yeah. We like Rare Replay. Have you mentioned that? It is.
It's if you have not had the chance to play it, you need to get it for, like I said last time, for this amount of money, you cannot buy this amount of quality gaming for that amount of money.
Yeah.
You just can't.
Yeah.
And it's not just the games, but it's all the material that comes with it.
Yeah. And the snapshots, those are really fun too.
Yeah, and just everything. It's the best game compilation you can get right now.
Yep.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Especially for that amount of money.
Yeah. Yeah, Brandon and I could probably spend the entire show talking about Rare Replay, but I think we'll just move on. What else have you been playing?
The other major, well, actually, kind of sort of I've started doing Life is Strange episode 4, but not much because you got to it's Xbox One and you got to download this shit. So but the other thing I've been playing, if you can call it playing, is Her Story. Those of you who aren't familiar with this, basically what it is an interactive movie game. It's basically sort of a mystery where you're on this sort of fictitious computer monitor and you're looking at watching all of these police interviews that took place back in 1994 with this British woman talking about the death of her ex-husband. And she's considered a suspect in it. And the majority of the game, as it is basically you go through all these clips and listen to them. And for the record, these clips are very well acted. She's a very good actress, and the actual material is very gripping. And what you do is, as you're listening to these things, you go into the sort of the things database and you type in various keywords that you get out of the interview. So like she'll mention she's getting interviewed and she'll mention the Oxford University because her ex-husband was a professor at Oxford, and you type in Oxford and you'll get some videos that you hadn't watched yet. And it's really gripping. It's basically you getting all these puzzle pieces and trying to piece them together to get what actually happened.
What?
And that's basically the game, but it's really gripping. It's PC.
Okay.
Yeah,
that actually sounds really cool.
Yeah.
I've heard about it a little bit in passing, but...
Yeah, it's one of those, the actual gameplay is minimal, but the actual everything else is actually really interesting. And it's just, it's gripping. It's, you genuinely want to know what this person's story is and what happened to her ex-husband.
Well, this sounds really cool in the sense that it's a game that really actually makes you use your brain. So.
Yeah. And the thing is, everything about this game is made so very authentic, like the dress, the clothing is authentic, hairstyles are authentic. She seems to visibly age over the sort of scattered timeline. Her clothes change, and even the video itself is kind of grainy, so it looks like it was actually filmed in 94. And like I said, it's the actual, although the game is mostly the database, there's like other stuff that's on this sort of fictitious computer monitor that you can look at. And, it's got notes and stuff. And yeah, it's really neat. They even have a glare that they put on this computer monitor, and it's sort of like curved at the edges. So
yeah, it looks like a CRT monitor from the 90s.
like an old Macintosh.
Yeah.
It's really neat. For a game that's so minimalistic, it's surprisingly gripping.
And where can you get this?
I got it as a gift from one of my friends. I'm pretty sure you can get it off of Steam.
Yeah, I will have to check this out because this sounds really intriguing.
My
interest has peaked, definitely.
Yeah, it's on Steam.
If one thing is, when she's talking, you really do have to, pay attention, because she can, they do give you subtitles and stuff like that too. But she can talk sort of fast sometimes.
Yeah.
And it can get kind of, it's, as you get towards it, it does get kind of, it can get a little frustrating towards the end, because again, this is stuff where you're trying to find these keywords, but it is very gripping. And we got the link for Steam on here over on the side.
Cool. I'm going to check this out when I have money.
Yeah,
well, it's $6, so
it's not much. All right. And yeah, Lee, you've had a hell of a week, so you probably haven't played very much.
Yeah, I haven't had much time to play anything. I'm still doing the usual, you know, popping into WoW sometimes. My wife actually has been home for a couple of days. She's leaving again for business, but she decided to fire up Dragon Age, so Inquisition. So I've been watching her do that, and that's one of those games that I loved the first Dragon Age, but I honestly could not see myself playing Inquisition. I don't know why. It's a game that has interested me, but like when I watched her, like with the mission table and everything else like that, I was just like, you know what? I'm good. Like, yeah. And I think it's because of the fact that I've played MMOs for so long that when a single player game tends to copy some MMO style things, it just doesn't do it for me. Like, I know a lot of people really loved Final Fantasy 12. I know for a lot of people mm-hmm. it was very divisive. A big part of the reason why I had trouble getting into that game, even though I did put a lot of time into it, but a big reason I had a lot of trouble playing it is that it's an MMO single player game. Like,
yeah.
I'm sort of, I guess I'm at the point too where it comes to like games where, you know, I grew up around arcades, and so mm-hmm. I would prefer a non-fake multiplayer. You know what I mean?
Mm, yeah.
Like,
yeah.
There's just something absolutely cool about being able to go into like a giant world or something like that with your friends. It's what back in the Game Addicts days, when we were all jumping on PSO together, when on our Dreamcasts, you know.
Those were good times.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Like, I mean, I remember I skipped work at one point. I mean, I think at one point, like, Pat, me, you, and God, I think it might have been Bill. I think we were logged in for like 15 hours straight.
I think Teresa was there too.
Teresa, yeah, yeah. I mean, it was just, and that was one of those things that was sort of like, in a way, really not transcendence, probably not the best way to describe it, but whatever. I mean, it's just like,
mm-hmm. It was formative. It was
fun to do. Yeah, it was absolutely fun to do with your friends. And so, like, whenever I look at any of these games where they do that kind of thing, I'm like, okay, well, you know, I guess. And so, like, looking at Dragon Age, it's like, oh, so you have a mission table. You have this. You have to go here. You have to do that. Yeah, I'm good. I'm straight.
Yeah. So. Yeah, for me, it's a bit different because I don't play MMOs, like, at all. So even mechanics don't really bother me all that much.
Yeah.
And it's like, I don't know, I guess different strokes for different folks and type thing.
Yeah. No, I could totally see that. I mean, and it's legit. Yeah. But just for me, I'm like, yeah, I think I'm all right.
Yeah, yes. Simulated multiplayer. And as far as RPGs go, I think if you're going offline, then total party control is a must have. Hmm. But I've run into exactly one instance where I got hooked by a game that simulated multiplayer, and that was Dot Hack. But that was so carefully constructed and so well put together that it got away with it, partly because it was the whole idea behind it.
Yeah. Dot Hack was, you know, trying to kind of simulate the online and offline world at the same time. For the most part, it got away with it. It actually was.
Yeah, it didn't resonate with a lot of people, but I was one of those people who was just completely immersed in it and pretty much stuck with it through the entire run.
Hmm. Yeah.
I still hold those four games as like some of the peak of my PlayStation 2 experience.
Yeah. Yeah, but I've been doing that and I've been trying to, I'm in this weird like mix actually. Like I have been playing So yeah, log in a while, you know, every once in a while for this week. Still trying to put in a little time with Heroes of the Storm. I'm still getting the hang of that whole MOBA thing. It's not really something that I've played before. So like, I was playing with my buddy CJ the other day, and she was like, "You can't rush too fast," because like I'm playing like a warrior type character, and like I just want to go in and beat the crap out of people. And they're like, "No, there's like an ebb and flow into this." I'm like, "Screw that! The guy's right there. I'm gonna murder him." You know? So I'm trying to adjust to like to that kind of play style, and I've been playing. I've been going back through Dragon Quest V on my DS. As lighthearted as the majority of Dragon Quests tend to be, I completely forgot like how like kind of like raw that one is.
Yeah,
and just you know like for you know I'm not going to ruin it for anybody else, but I assume you guys have played it. And you know kind of like what happens to the main character just like in the very beginning. Mm-hmm. And it's just like, Jesus. It's like, so, wow. This like, this is a little like dark and heavy. I was not and I knew, I mean, I'd never finished five. I had gotten it when the DS came out or when the DS version came out. And I never really got around to putting in much time to it. Particularly because nine had kept me so busy.
Oh, nine is one of the best.
Yeah, I've probably got 200 hours in that. Plus, I play nine with my son. But yeah, like, I mean, you go in there, you're 6 years old, having some adventures or some crazy stuff, and the next thing you know, you're a slave. Like, what?
Yeah.
Like, oh my God, 10 years. Oh my God. And then, like, I did have a part of the story ruined for me later, which was really kind of gut wrenching as well. And I'm just like, I don't know, man. I got to play this in spurts. So, like, I've kind of been grinding it more than anything else.
Yeah.
Just because it's like, I can only take so much doom and gloom at once. Like, because I think, as far as I can tell, this is really the only one of those games that goes, like, stupidly dark.
Like, strangely enough, it was the first one that we missed out on the first time it was released.
Yeah. And maybe that was part of it. Maybe, because I got to tell you, man, I've been just with this, as crazy as the week has been, I've been trying to do stuff that's like uplifting and upbeat.
Yeah. That's not one of them.
Nope.
But,
and I was just going to say, to frame this correctly, this was pretty much right at the dawn of the Super NES.
Yeah.
So.
Well, and I've just been, the only other thing that I've been doing that I've just been playing with is I got I have a flash cart for my GBA,
right,
and that's how I had played Mother 3 and stuff. And there are people out there that did hacks to certain ROMs to restore music, restore color palettes and stuff like that, because a lot of like Super Nintendo games that got ported to the GBA because of the front-lit screen, a lot of them had some of their color palettes adjusted. Like Final Fantasy VI has got a complete color rework, so it looks like the Super Nintendo version. And it also has – they restored the music. Now, some people can't really tell the difference. You know, the Super Nintendo sound chip was a monster for its time.
Yeah.
Some people can't really tell the difference, but I can. Like Final Fantasy VI is my favorite Final Fantasy. So, you know, you can – there's a certain harshness in tinny type of sound with the GBA version, but for whatever reason, these people that have done these ROM hacks have restored the sound and it sounds perfect. So I've been messing with that, and they did one for A Link to the Past as well.
Oh.
And going back through that game is something that I've been kind of doing on and off because my son has been playing Wind Waker and stuff like that, and I just kind of felt the urge. And A Link to the Past has always been my favorite Zelda game, and it's one of the greatest games of all time. And just really kind of going back through and because I remember when I played it, I played it with my friend Lee Burns, and we were 10, and he had won a Super Nintendo in a raffle at our school.
Wow.
Which that lucky bastard, he always wins stuff. I don't know what he's got going on, but he always wins stuff, and he won a Super Nintendo from a raffle at school, and we rented A Link to the Past when it came out. And we stayed up the whole night. It was during summer. We stayed up the whole night playing it. And then his mom had to work. So she worked in an office, and they had a spare room. And so we went with her to her office, and they had a little 12-inch black and white TV. And so we spent the whole day playing it on the 12-inch black and white TV.
All you need.
And yeah, and then finally went back that night and finished it off on the color TV. And going back and playing it, like, I'm sure for some people that didn't really play it at its time, it was one of those things where you can't really understand how insane it was to have that game. And I'm just playing it again, even playing it on the GBA screen, I'm just still taken aback at how forward thinking that game was. And just everything about it was fantastic, especially when, you know, you realize there's that middle. I wonder if, like, we're so jaded now as gamers. Like, do you guys remember that middle point when you finally confront Aghanim? And then you're like, you kind of expect the game to be over because of what we had been used to. And then all of a sudden it's like, nope, there's 8 more dungeons.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. Like,
proceed with the puking rainbows meme.
Yeah, I mean, just – yeah, and like, but whereas now it's like, what do you mean this game doesn't have 300 hours of content? Yeah, you know, yeah. And that kind of stuff. So it's been cool going back through and playing that. And I'm actually, it's got me excited for that, basically that Four Swords Adventures sequel that they're going to do for the 3DS. Cause I can
try Force Heroes.
Yeah, I can really see myself enjoying that with my kid. Cause that's something else that I never would have thought of. Like going back to like talking about playing with people, like it's cool to me to be able to play this stuff with my son.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Speaking of which, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, Zelda was not a game that anybody ever really thought about as a multiplayer thing. Hmm. So just being able to do that is awesome. So yeah, I've been really, it's like a little bit of the stuff that I normally do and then just some of the old, just so I can like feel better because things suck right now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Actually, the thing about Zelda, if you kind of think about it, the old Zelda games, especially the first one, We're kind of a collaborative type of game because it was one of those games where, you know, part of the fun of playing them was, you know, talking with your friends, you know, on the playground or whatever, and finding out, you know, what you needed to do next.
Everyone was because you get to these maps. Spots.
Yeah.
But really, the closest, really, as far as I can. I'm concerned the closest modern gaming equivalent to that is probably Dark Souls.
Yeah.
Yeah, I can see it.
You know, it's that same kind of thing where, you know, you're getting together and you're all trying to get through this thing together with giving each other advice and stuff. I mean, it's even a built-in part of the actual game.
Yeah.
But the old Zelda games were, the old Zelda games had that sort of social aspect to them that, you know, it was part of the fun part.
Yeah.
It's, you know, it's interesting that you mentioned that. It's actually
one of the fun parts of that game.
I was listening to Retronauts actually last night because they had done an episode on A Link to the Past, and somebody actually made a comment like, do you guys ever think that maybe like Dark Souls is like the new Zelda? And a lot of people were like, yeah, like that more like in the Zelda 1 style where like, because you remember Zelda 1, you could just go in and if you weren't ready, I mean, you just got your ass kicked.
Yeah.
So it's, you know, somebody brought that up. Like, you guys ever think that maybe Zelda 1 is sort of like the original Dark Souls in that sense? Like, you have complete freedom. Don't die.
Yeah.
You could wander into a dungeon you weren't meant to see for like another 3 or 4 levels.
Yeah. And
if you did, that was bad times.
Yeah, because that game was not shy about just wrecking you, just out of principle.
Yeah. Now, I think I've said this before, but it sounds like with this Wii U Zelda that's in the works, they're actually trying to get back to that.
That's what has me
so excited about the prospect of that game.
Yeah, I hope that one's good. I am a little bit concerned though, not so much for the Zelda thing, but I'm more concerned about. I'm more concerned about this whole. The industry right now has a really weird, stupid obsession with open worlds, and I one of the things that's been readily apparent replaying Link to the Past is. There's some real like high level game design going on with that game because it's not like Zelda 1 where in Zelda 1, if you were just in the wrong place, you got murdered. Like they had enough forethought and foresight to be able to kind of dangle things in front of you that you would want to be able to do, but not make it so and then you could still wander around and do everything else like that, but not make the world so constricted that you couldn't explore.
The original Zelda is one of the most merciless gaming experiences you will ever experience. Just it's that game literally throws you in the middle of it, and you know it will. You have to sink or swim. There is no other way.
No hand holding whatsoever. It's just drop you in. Oh, here's the sword.
None whatsoever. They don't even do that because you know the only way you know this the get the sword is that there's that one cave over there. People have beaten the game without the sword, which is
that's insane to me.
But it can be done.
I think for me the most interesting part about going back through and kind of replaying that has been I feel like that was the best Zelda game ever made simply because there was one of the things that has made these regular Zeldas, or the newer ones, so difficult for me to get through is the amount of hand-holding, just garbage, that you have to deal with. And Link to the Past really has none of that.
Yep.
But it's still not even as punishing as, like, the original Zelda. But in a lot of ways, I think that's probably one of the most perfect games ever made. Mm-hmm.
The thing is, you have to remember, Link to the Past, you know, was still being made when, you know, game manuals were still a big part of the actual gaming experience.
Yeah.
Games like, you know, a Skyward Sword and stuff, you know, and those days, you know, at this point, gaming manuals are all but completely phased out.
Yeah, and
it's like a catch-22 because if Nintendo came out now and made a proper, you know, full 3D Legend of Zelda in the mold of the last few and did it on the understanding that that people understand the controls, they understand L targeting, they understand all these things, how to work the menus and everything, they would get crucified by reviewers, by any random first timers that this happened to be their first Zelda game. I don't know. I'd like to see them just go ahead with it because I really think that's one of the main things that has to be done in order to fix the series.
Yeah.
But it just worries me that just in the current gaming climate, it seems like there would be consequences for leaving the 3-hour tutorials out.
Yeah.
And that's depressing.
Yeah.
See, I guess for me, the way that I look at it is you can forget like the time frame that it came out in and everything. Is that game obviously was so there? Every Zelda game afterwards has been completely molded off of it. Every single one of them. It's the template, and I think we can sit here, we can talk about instruction manuals and everything else like that. But I think that the biggest reason that it succeeds is because there is a level of purity in that game that I don't think we've seen since it came out. Like, I think Ocarina of Time, you know, did it pretty well. I still think that game is overrated. I think it's extremely overrated.
Yes.
But I think it's overrated simply because it came out, frankly, after A Link to the Past, because it doesn't do anything different than A Link to the Past, except that it's in 3D. And I played on PC.
I mean, they even put the
time. Go ahead.
Dark World aspect into it.
Yeah, I mean, everything about it was sort of like
brought the Dark World in.
Yeah.
Everything that it did was sort of a copy of what they did before, and I guess maybe that's part of the reason why it didn't really impress me. Hmm.
Do think they kind of screwed up the gameplay in the move to 3D, though.
Yeah, I think that's maybe. But like, I also think, like, for instance, though, I think Wind Waker is a fantastic game.
I love Wind Waker.
I'm looking forward to the new Zelda simply because I'm hoping that it does something that will surprise me. Because
they said pretty They've said pretty openly that they're trying to get back to the roots of the original Zelda. And, you know, one of the roots to the original Zelda was that wide open, you know, experience.
Yep. Right. Yeah. We could probably talk about Zelda for like the whole show because
right,
there's
yeah,
just
sorry,
so
I
much.
Yeah,
oh, I'm sure we've got.
Well, we
got
to get off
about it.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah. That, we got.
Yeah, we got to get
to get into Doka.
Yeah. Anyways, Pat, you want to take us through these quick bits?
Well, the first one here you actually brought to my attention, and I appreciate. Shout out to a friend of the show, YouTube, Let's Play. Host L1011 Widebody starting a NHL 95 PC Let's Play, and he's taken a really interesting approach with it. He's pretty much erasing the entire roster of Anaheim Ducks for that season and replacing them with whatever fan submissions he gets as far as skaters go, being that he's the goalie. And yeah. So he's going to be playing through a full schedule in real days. So going by the 93-94 schedule, he's going to be starting on October 8th. And that will be against the Detroit Red Wings. And it's just going to be interesting to see how this whole thing plays out with the players he gets handed by his viewers. I've signed up for it just because I think it sounds like a really fun idea and sort of a retro alternative to the whole be a pro concept that we see in today's NHL titles.
Yeah.
So
only you're not playing it and somebody else is.
No.
Yeah.
That's pretty cool.
So this next one, was this yours, Phil?
Yeah, I added this one in. Just a quick note that, if you're a fan of Rare Replay, and we are, and you like the behind-the-scenes content, the folks at Rare are going to be continuing that, and they're going to be posting those new behind-the-scenes videos on their YouTube channel. So just quick heads up there. And if you like that kind of stuff, you're going to get more of it. Just subscribe to their YouTube channel, and it'll show up in your feed.
Yeah. The behind the scenes stuff that has to do with Rare is always really gripping to watch.
Yeah, it's
watch because they're a very unique game company when it comes to their design.
Yeah. There's that. And finally, looks like Tabata's. Is saying we're going to have Final Fantasy 15 in 2016. Looks like that's when it's going to launch. So, yeah.
That's not all that far-fetched to me.
No, it seems about right, given the progress that they're making with the Duske demo.
Yeah, which I still haven't gone back to. I just I need to one of these times, but the first playthrough I did when it first came out just left such a bad taste in my mouth that I don't want to go back. But yeah, really important game for Square Enix. I think they're, from things that I've read over time, they're kind of positioning themselves to maybe take the wrong message from it, but I don't know. It's one of those games where I understand that it needs to be a success, and therefore I want it to be a success, but I'm just not feeling it based on everything that I've seen, based on what I've played of it. So, we'll see how it turns out, but
yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah, you'll have to give that updated demo a try and see if it changes your opinion at all.
Oh, I would love that. But we just talked about how important full party control is. And it's one of those things where I don't like the whole action, real-time, simulated multiplayer feel that it's going for. And I think that's so intrinsically tied to its entire concept at this point that there's really no getting out of it. And the problem is that Square Enix seems to be tying this game and its potential success to what they see as the prospects of JRPGs as an entire genre, which you really can't facepalm hard enough when you hear something like that. So,
yeah, and yet, they're still bringing out Project mm-hmm. Setsuna, and they're setting up a JRPG studio. So, they seem like a company that's very conflicted right now about what they want to do.
Yeah, and I hope they come out of it okay. Most of all, even if Final Fantasy 15 isn't what it needs to be, maybe they can take a look at Atlus and Falcom and see what those guys are doing, and finally realize that the types of games that made Square Enix what they are have never really gone away.
Yeah,
the problem is they just haven't been making them.
Yeah.
That's the problem, yeah. They've kind of forgotten how to make them, apparently. I don't know. We'll see if that turns out to be the case or not. Yeah, Brandon, you back? Apparently not.
According to Game Informer, bringing this to our attention, Chrono Trigger, 20 years
old. Yeah, I got it.
Yeah.
Yep. Sorry about that. I got cut off for a second. I forgot to mention we had some weather over here earlier.
Yeah.
So that might be interfering with the connection a little bit. But yesterday, Chrono Trigger officially turned 20 years old.
Yeah. Oh, God, the memories. Does
it ever bother you guys to think about the fact that our Super Nintendos are like drinking age?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. But just give an idea, the Chrono Trigger is pretty much, arguably, but almost across the board, considered to be the best JRPG of all time. Better than Final Fantasy VII or VI, better than Dragon Quest. Just it's the one that tops them all.
Well, yeah, and the reason for that is because it's almost the perfect amalgamation of Dragon Quest and Final Fantasy.
The whole game, basically, they got the ultimate dream team of people who were in the JRPG scene at the time. Like, for example, the game was basically directed and produced by Kirinobu Sakaguchi, the man who gave us, who of course created the Final Fantasy series. It was more or less conceived of, the whole project, by Yuji Ori, the man who, of course, gave it this Dragon Quest.
Yeah.
The actual story and script was written by Masato Kato, who was also he would actually be the design lead on Chrono Cross, the sequel, and he also wrote the script for this particular game and the original Xenogears. He's kind of a big deal in writing JRPGs. Mm-hmm.
And looking at some of the people who were on staff in this game, you almost wonder how Enix let him do it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. The music, they had both music. They had Nobuo Uematsu, which, of course, is just a win. And they also had a youngster by the name of Yasunori Mitsuda, who, of course, would go on to be one of the big major composers in the game. And of course, who can forget the art direction by Mr. Akira Toriyama?
Some of his best work, really.
Yeah,
his aesthetic just works for this game.
Yeah,
in just the most incredible ways. And there's a reason this game turned out as good as it was. It had all of this amazing talent on hand.
Yeah.
Some of them did some of their. Sorry, Brandon. We sort of seemed to desync. I wasn't trying to talk over you.
It's all right.
But what I was gonna say is I think the craziest part about it too is that I think a big reason that it's so successful as well, is that there's no filler in the game. There's no pretense. There's no 5-hour tutorial. The biggest thing that's the tutorial is the very beginning at the fair, and that's it.
Yep.
As soon as that's done, you're off to the races. And
that
the game
fair come and the stuff you do in that fair actually comes back at you later on.
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, I've got to share a story. Because this experience stayed with me, and I was doing the story campaign in Heaven's Ward on Final Fantasy 14. Basically, the story takes you into a country called Dravania, which is an entire nation inhabited by dragons who are at war with the Asgardians that you've been helping pretty much since Heaven's Ward started, and actually going back a little further than that, considering some of the final story arcs in A Realm Reborn. And being an MMO, I'm getting ahead of myself. The main story has you basically trying to broker peace between the humans in Ishgard and the Dravanians, and you're trying to get on the Dravanians' good side and, get as much goodwill going as possible. Side quests don't stop coming at you. And so, you've got these two tribes of dragons that are fighting each other on either side of this bridge when you're pretty much at the heart of Dravania. And one of these little side quests is that go knock off a couple of each side, and that ought to calm them down for a while. And I'm in the middle of just doing this side quest, and I'm crossing the bridge to go to meet with the main dragon. And I'm just thinking, oh my god, I hope this isn't some kind of Chrono Trigger fair thing. I don't want this. I don't want to be going on trial here and be like, I didn't do it. I did. And it would have been a perfect place to put that sort of thing.
Yeah.
But the fact that experience kind of stayed with me, and I. It for a moment it even made me forget that as an MMO it kind of had to all go in the same direction. Thankfully it didn't end up that way. Other story stuff played out instead, but it really gave me pause when I was doing all these side quests, because the go kill X number of whatever creature happens to be in the area is just as prevalent in Dravania as it is anywhere else.
Yeah.
And a lot of that involves just killing off a lot of dragons. And it felt weird doing that while my character in the main storyline is trying to be this goodwill ambassador from the humans. I hope there's no Chrono Trigger going on right now, because this is going to look bad.
Yeah,
I wonder sometimes how many people were like me when they first played that fair part in Chrono Trigger, and really were surprised to see that all that stuff came back to bite them in the ass.
Yeah, I was surprised. I mean, I was young. Really, I wasn't expecting game design. Yeah,
and the thing is, because I mean, it kind of broke with sort of the what was kind of common in JRPGs at that point. Everybody remember, you go into somebody's house, you get an item or just pick stuff up. It's not, it was par for the course. Nobody was going to come back and get you for it. And then all of a sudden you're playing Chrono Trigger and all this stuff comes back at you.
Yeah.
Ever since then, anytime I go, I always feel weird about going into somebody's house and jacking stuff.
Yeah.
Because I'm like, this isn't going to go over well.
This is going to be held against me later.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, if you think about it on a technical level, as I tend to do, all of that stuff is, it's stuff that takes up memory. You got to keep state of all of that, all those decisions that you make, the whatever you happen to do at the fair or who you pissed off. And when the Super NES only has like 256K of RAM, it's actually kind of remarkable that they managed to pull as much of that stuff off as they did.
I think that for a lot of those, it's just the difference between a 1 and a 0.
Yeah.
Still. Like pretty much everything that happened, at the fair, I think, could be summed up in a single 8-character binary string.
Yeah, but it wasn't just the fair, though. I mean, they did that throughout the entire game.
Yeah,
you know, and that's what was really remarkable about Chrono Trigger.
And I mean, the thing is, if you do all that stuff in that game, it actually changes what parts of the game you go into. I mean, there's whole sections of the game you might not even experience.
Yeah, that was the first RPG that I remember playing that had distinct endings. Because what are they, 10?
Yeah, we're 10.
Yeah, there's like 10 of them.
Hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think
you guys see why, I think so, you listeners out there, do you see why this game is starting to see why this game is held up so highly?
Yeah, it's just, well,
and it's one of those, thankfully, because of the art style and because of the, like, I mean, it was relatively forward thinking as well. Like there were no random encounters. I mean, there were stuff that they designed that you had to run into. But you would also, you know, if you wanted to avoid somebody on the road, you could, because, you know, they had the characters there instead of just it being, oh, the map flashes and then now you're stuck, you know, fighting the same thing over and over again. Like, yeah, that was something else that was really
cool. Chrono Trigger pretty much ruined random encounters for me ever after.
Yeah, did for me too.
And it did it nice.
Because once they showed it that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because once you see this, like, why isn't everyone else doing this?
Yeah.
The craziest part about it for me actually has nothing to do with the game. When that game came out, I mean, Super Nintendo games were anywhere from $50 to $100. And I remember my mom asking me that Christmas, like, what I wanted. And I was like, I want Chrono Trigger. And we were really, really poor at the time. And she was like, Lee, I can't. Like, if you get that, that's going to be the only thing that you get. And I was like, Mom, I don't care. You know, like, this is what I want, blah, 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 blah. And she came through that year. She got me that, and she got me, like, two other things. But I will never, ever forget it. Like, I still have the game. I will never sell it. Just, of course, and it's worth it, you know, a good chunk of money now. But I'll never sell it because my mom, like, sacrificed to get me that. Yeah. So that's another reason why it has a really, really strong place, like, in my heart, because it was, like, yeah, it was phenomenal. And I think that made me enjoy the game even more because it's just over delivered on pretty much everything that you could expect.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which kind of makes you feel bad for the guys who did Chrono Cross, because Chrono Cross was a good game, but I mean, God, how do you follow that up?
Yeah. Really.
I think Chrono Cross actually ended up the way that it did because of that idea. It was like, I think actually, I personally think Chrono Cross gets a bad rap. I think it's actually a very good game. I think the battle system is great. I think the problem with it is that it has the Chrono name in front of it. If it didn't, people would like that game a lot more.
Yeah.
And, you know, there were, I think EGM actually, no, GameSpot at the time gave it a 10. And I remember people throwing a fit over that. Yeah. But it's a really interesting game. Like, but story wise, it doesn't, you know, like if you look deeper into it and a lot of the stuff that they were talking about, it's really kind of fascinating because instead of talking about time travel, it's dimensional travel, which is, you know, once you start actually getting into how time works and everything, you have to deal with the idea of dimensions and everything. But I think people expected Chrono Trigger 2.
Yeah,
and I think that's why the game was really kind of judged harshly when it probably didn't deserve it. And then it did take missteps where, you know, pretty much none of the characters actually really mattered. I remember Guile was in the game, and not Street Fighter Guile, but there was a character named Guile, and I remember the running theme for a long time was actually Magus. you know, there's a lot of that stuff, so. You know, again, I just don't think it got a very, very I don't think it got a fair shot because of its lineage, frankly.
Yeah.
And what it's really it's that bothers me because I feel like it's an incredibly underrated game. It has the best soundtrack, I think, besides Final Fantasy VI that I've ever heard. the soundtrack in that game is stunning. And as one of the last PlayStation 1 games, it's one of the most colorful games I've ever seen. I mean, it's a beautiful game. The whole thing, a lot of it just really, really works. And it's just, it's one of those games where it's kind of like, man, if it just didn't have the Chrono name in front of it, I think people would have really, really liked it.
Yeah. I mean, if they had, like you said, if they had, say, instead of calling it Chrono Cross, if they had called it maybe Quantum Cross.
Then there would be no dilemma.
Nope.
Yeah.
Oh, that's a shame, too, because it is a very good game.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think the fact that they kind of, any ties that game had to the original were really subtle.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, they do have a part that comes out and, you know, kind of lets you know where everything stands. But even then, it's not, it almost felt like the callback was sort of ancillary. Like, this was just something that we have to do. You know, so.
They danced around it more than anything.
Yeah exactly.
Well, and other RPG news. GOG has brought back a whole bunch of classic D&D Forgotten Realms RPGs. You got 13 of them, including the Eye of the Beholder trilogy. So, yeah, if you were a fan of those back in the 90s, you need to go get this pack because lots of good stuff there. Yeah. And Menza Branzen, which kind of gets a bad rap for being a little on the generic side, but wasn't too bad. Hell, it had Drizzt on the cover, so, you know, can't go wrong there. I'm a nerd. So sue me.
We all are.
Yeah.
That's why we're here.
Yeah. I love the
idea. We all grew up on cheesy Forgotten Elves novels.
Yeah. It's funny. I'm actually going through a lot of those, on audiobook now that has them.
We've all read our Waite and R.A. Salvatore books.
Actually, I have not.
I still do.
I have not. Although I did get exposed to him with the work that he did on Kingdoms of Amalur.
Yeah.
And,
he did stuff on that.
That game story was like cool for about 10 minutes, and then it just got really
generic.
That was another game, though, man. If all the politics and stuff aside, that was one of those games I really would have loved to have seen a sequel to, because the way it really sound, I really enjoyed the world and everything. But it just it's one of those games that actually kind of reminded me a little bit of like the Old Republic, because they had obviously spent a shit ton of money on Kingdoms of Amalur for like the voice acting. I mean, practically everything was voice acting, but it was all like just this same like nonsense.
Yeah.
And you were just like,
well, they spent a shitload of money on it. It's more like the taxpayers of Rhode Island spent a shit.
That's a different story. Like that, you guys ever want to have a business conversation about what happened there? Like, definitely Kurt Schilling is kind of a dirtbag for the stuff that went down, but it was also very much a product of the economic times where politicians were so scared and they absolutely needed to try and do everything that they could to attract jobs to their states. And that's kind of what led to some of it. And I'm actually really interested, like Lincoln Chafee, he was the governor of Rhode Island. He came in after the deal was made and he criticized the hell out of it. He's running for president right now. So he's not going to get anywhere near the nomination, but I'm really curious to see what people will say, because that's going to be something that'll get brought up. Like, and think about that. Like, normally during election time, the only time that video games get brought up is when people want to ban them, not for something like this.
Yeah.
So that might actually be kind of interesting to see.
Yeah. Make up some popcorn because it's going to be fun.
So moving on now. What's left of Konami is wondering what games you want back. This is one of the most surreal stories I can imagine right now.
I love that we've already gone to the point of calling it what's left of Konami.
Yeah, well, there's not a whole lot of talent left under their umbrella.
This feels like a fire sale survey. Like, what is the last? We have all of these things here, and I feel like they're doing that to figure out what they can make money off of at the tail end. And then that can also help them if they decide to sell the IPs to someone else.
Yeah.
They can go, we got this directly from our customers that says this stuff is valuable. This, you know, this series means a lot to them. So give us more money for it, because they don't seem interested in making games anymore. No, so
that's true.
I could totally see it be like a situation like where THQ liquidated everything, and then a couple of basically, you know, a bunch of different studios got the chance to buy into some stuff.
Yeah,
and there are some dream combinations that come out of this list too. I mean, if some of these were to end up at certain studios, I would not complain at all.
Yeah.
Interesting that Metal Gear and Silent Hill are missing from the list.
Yeah.
Don't know the Enders isn't.
I think part of that too is any sort of movie distribution rights that they have in place, or they want to be able to sell that stuff off.
Yeah,
those are their most popular franchises.
Yeah,
and with comic book movies taking off, you know, video game stuff is not, you know, has been a smaller section of the industry, but they've, you know, you've had successful video game movies. And, you know, when you have someone like Guillermo del Toro showing that kind of interest in something like Silent Hill, I mean, there's got to be tons of people in Hollywood that are going, hey, maybe there's something to this.
Yeah.
And, you know,
unfortunately, now he's so done he can't stand it. And
yeah, but you know what? That guy's
I can't blame him.
He's a drama queen. He's always been like that. He's like, yeah, I want to do this. Like, he, okay, now let me rephrase. He is not a drama queen, but he is definitely, to a certain point, like, he takes the ideas of things and he sort of like runs away with them and just kind of goes nuts. Mm-hmm. He kind of reminds me in a lot of ways of like Peter Molyneux, where he just has these really crazy ideas and then they don't always deliver.
Yeah.
But, you know, I imagine that's probably the kind of thing where he does seem like a very passionate dude. So he probably got super involved in the idea of a lot of this stuff. And so then when it couldn't actually happen, he took it as like a defeat or something like that.
Yeah. Either that, or you know, he'll do that, or he'll either. Yeah, either that, or he'll like take up a bunch of projects at once, like, you know, Robert Rodriguez, and then just get completely overloaded and just kind of burns out.
Yeah.
Interesting list of franchises that they've they do have on their list, though. Parodius is on there, Rocket Knight. Suikoden, of course. Bomberman, Mystical Ninja, which I wouldn't mind seeing again in some form or another. Wow, International Track and Field.
Valiant Hearts.
Vandal Hearts, yeah. I would love to see more of that series.
Yeah, we did get one a few years back.
I try not to think about that.
Yeah, me neither. Yeah,
I love that. That was when I got my PlayStation 1. That was one of the first games that I bought, because I was blown away. Like, what I took a chance on that and Suikoden, because they were both $34.99 at Best Buy. Like, they weren't $50. They weren't, and you know, it was like Ridge Racer, Suikoden, and Vandal Hearts. And
oh man, you were set.
I was, and Toshinden.
Nice,
good old Toshinden.
Yeah.
Another franchise I wouldn't mind seeing come back. That's out of Konami's hands, but
yeah, it's probably floating around Shinden. The ether somewhere.
Come for the fight, to Shinden. Come for the fighting, stay for the Russian dominatrix with the whip.
Yeah, I do love how they just own that. I mean, like, okay, yes, we did that. Okay, what, you got a problem with that?
Nope.
Yeah.
What? What you gonna do? You gonna fight about it?
Well, pick a game.
Here's our game. Fight away.
Yeah.
We're ready for that.
And then Toshinden 3 came out and began the downward spiral of the franchise as a whole. So
there was some weird attempted reboot on the Wii, but that never really went anywhere. And
yeah, it was Dream Factory, so God damn it. That, yeah. Unless you liked Urguys.
It was all right.
Okay. Yeah.
But Toshinden on the Wii was not Air Guys either.
Nope.
No.
It was a lot of things. Good was not one of them.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Damn, Phil.
Well, have you played the game?
Yes, of course I have, but still.
It was bad.
I was putting them on Front Street.
Yeah. I mean, that Castlevania fighting game on the Wii was actually better than this.
Remember when they would just come out with fighting games for almost anything?
Yeah.
Yeah, I do. I remember some pretty bad ones, too.
Hmm.
Like that Double Dragon fighting game.
Yeah.
That was based on the Saturday morning cartoon.
Oh, God.
Yeah.
There was actually a pretty good one on the Neo Geo.
Yeah.
But that one was more inspired by the movie.
Yeah. At least that's how it started. There was that little one clip of the film in the intro, and then they didn't bother referencing it ever.
It just went off on its own. It was better for it.
It also had the BJ theme, so that's awesome. If you're a fan of Classic Game Room, you will know what that means.
Yeah,
moving on. Evolution Studios teasing more big stuff for Drive Club this year, and I'm very happy about that because Drive Club kind of gets a bad rap.
Yeah, it deserves better than it got, and if this is season two, which I can only imagine that it is, so much the better. You know, hopefully this gets a chance to really grow into its potential and ultimately become the game that was shown off to us leading up to the PS4 launch.
Yeah.
It's not there yet, but it's still one of my favorite driving games of this generation so far.
Yep.
And if they can really make the community aspect of it work the way it's supposed to, and more importantly, bring people back to the game as a whole, it could do some pretty good stuff. I still have hope for it.
Yeah. You know, I'm hoping that they'll, you know, take some of the community suggestions, like, you know, a full-on arcade-style race-type mode, because Drive Club's system is almost there as far as that goes.
Yeah.
You know, as far as their handling goes, it's not super realistic, but it's not super arcadey either. It's kind of floating that mushy middle. And
it's occupying the territory that stuff like Project Gotham used to.
Yeah. So, I mean, if they put in a, you know, if they go all Far Cry Blood Dragon and just go completely over the top as a side mode like that, I think a lot of people will dig that.
I think with stuff like Drift Stage on the way, it'd be perfect.
Yeah. Yeah, Drift Stage is getting a lot of buzz now.
It's remarkable. Deserved, absolutely.
Yeah.
We haven't given them a shout out on the show in quite a while, and that's a shame. But Drift Stage, if you haven't looked into it, it really is the return of some of those vintage arcade racers that came out right as the whole genre moved to 3D.
What I love about Drift Stage, though, is, yes, it's a 3D game, okay? It's being built on Unity, but they're making it look like a 2D game.
It looks like Rad Racer.
Yeah, it's amazing.
Point blank. And
right down to the fake reflections on the glass.
Yep.
That's awesome. It's just stylistically, mm-hmm. It's a really cool game.
Yep.
So yeah, that's Drive Club and a little bit of Drift Stage. Pining. I want to play that game so bad. Anyway. And you put in this next one, Pat?
Yeah. Pokken Tournament, the bizarre kind of
Pokemon fighting game.
it's a sort of Pokemon Tekken spinoff by Katsuhiro Harada. And it was only slated for arcades, even though we knew it wasn't going to stay there. Now we know that it's coming to the Wii U in the spring, whether that's a global timetable or just in Japan. I have no idea at this point, but the inevitable console release is now confirmed.
Yeah.
And so that's something we can look forward to.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's not really that surprising that it would end up on the Wii U. I mean, because it is, you know, a Nintendo property here. If it ended up on the PS4 and Xbox One, then it would have been really surprising.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And be like, what?
You know, previously in Pokemon, they'd only, you know, sort of kind of only hinted at the destruction that comes from a Pokemon battle. Now you can actually see it.
Yep. Yeah, this looks really cool. I mean, I'm not a fan of Pokemon. I don't really care, but I like fighting games and I like unique concepts, and this is kind of both. So
I personally believe that if there's any Nintendo property that could actually pull off a really gritty reboot, it would be Pokemon.
Get all, yeah.
Simply because of all the implications of Pokemon and the world it takes place in.
Yeah.
Seems.
Yeah. Yeah, you know what they need to do? They need to hire Joe Abercrombie to help reboot Pokemon.
Yeah, he could definitely pull it off.
Yeah.
And not only that, get someone like and when they're like doing the redesigns for the Pokemon, get someone like I don't know, someone like McFarlane or Gerald Brom or someone who can just take. Or what about that dude on DeviantArt who makes the realistic Pokemon art? Get him.
Yeah. I don't know who he is, but I have seen some of his work, and it's like, that is just wrong.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. You got to remember, Pokemon, at its heart, is about you capturing innocent forest creatures and forcing them to fight each other.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's basically cockfighting the game.
Yeah.
It's just that, you know, they don't die. They, quote-unquote, faint.
Yeah. And they just kind of float around for the rest of the...
Yeah.
Anyway. So, Pokken Tournament. Some sad news for NYC fighting fans. The, you know, institution that was the Next Level looks like it's going to be shuttering its doors at the end of February of 2016. Wonder how this happened.
Yeah, all indications are that it's just clashing between the two owners. Mm-hmm. It all kind of came to a head on stream, actually.
Ooh.
Yeah. Spooky, actually, kind of went full disclosure about it when opening up a Next Level Battle Circuit stream, and details aren't all that plentiful right now. It sounds like there's going to be some kind of successor location already in the works, but as far as Next Level as we know it, it would be probably up to Henry Sen to find a new partner or just the new location. I've seen some talk that there's hope that they can save the current location, but that sounds like a long shot.
Yeah.
It's just a real shame to see this happen because it's really one of the best fighting game community venues out there, and I'm just hoping that whatever it comes out the other side of this as can live up to that.
Yeah. You know, it just goes to show that sometimes, you know, business deals sometimes go bad. I mean,
yep.
Street Fighter 5 beta news.
No, I'm here. That's one of those things that's just disappointing to hear about. Like, you know, Mike Watson is having some issues with this Super Arcade stuff.
Yeah.
And, like, I know Watson, and he's a great guy. He is all about the community, and, you know, they're getting shoved out on his end. by people being ignorant about games.
Yeah.
I mean, it's crazy. Like, there's a lot of talk over there on their end, you know, that a big part of the reason why they don't want, that to be there is because there has been crime and like rapes and all kinds of stuff. And almost like they're sort of content to let that area kind of squander. And you know, it's just one of those things. Like, we're just in a different time now. There's not much room, I think, for any type of arcade venue or anything else like that, because there are a lot of older folks that still seem to have the idea that if you have these kinds of things around you, you're going to be entertaining criminals or something like
that.
Yeah.
You know, and it's a shame. So
there's that.
Oh, so what is the exact situation with Super Arcade now? I heard there were these like city council meetings going on, and
as far as I know,
trying to rally the troops to make sure that it was well represented at those. Or
and as far as I know, that's still the case. I haven't kept up with it. I haven't had a lot of time to look into it. I know I did see some stuff that they basically had on like their kind of like their public access channel, that showed Mike, you know, basically going up front and, you know, in a suit and kind of testifying about, you know, this kind of being a positive thing. And a lot of it too seems to revolve around the landowner, who has apparently sort of let the area squander, and there's no security there or anything else like that. And so that's part of the reasons why bad things have been able to happen, is because there's no tenant. I think there's one tenant in that whole building, in that whole shopping center. You know, I don't know. It just goes back to the whole thing where, you know, a lot of older people just seem to think that gamers are nothing but trouble. And on one hand, it's sort of difficult for me to – it pisses me off, because I'm like, you know, not everybody's like that. But at the same time, you see this stupid stuff on the news where somebody's getting swatted, you know.
Yeah.
It's you know, when you hear about all the negativity, the toxicity online, all of these things, it's also not really hard to believe that could also turn itself – into something that is manifested physically and into something ugly. Yeah. That's certainly not the case with lots, you know, but then again, you know, we've had the fighting game community where, you know, there's a certain section of it, like with Marvel, where getting extremely rowdy is part of it. Hmm. You know?
Yeah.
I mean, hell, when we do Final Round, I mean, I know, we thankfully we're on the ground floor, so we don't bother anybody. But I always wonder sometimes that you go to any of these fighting game tournaments, what kind of complaints the hotels are dealing with, because the fighting game community people are going to sit there and they're going to have their doors open until 3 o'clock in the morning, screaming, shouting, yelling, doing everything possible, just because that's something that they enjoy. Like, I would hate to be somebody that was traveling on business and then I ended up in a hotel where there was a fighting game tournament that week.
Get your first exposure to hype.
Yeah, you know, like, mm-hmm. I gotta be up at 6 in the morning and somebody's like, what about that Marvel? Like, you know, it would be awful, dude.
Yeah.
You know?
That reminds me of Evo 09 all over again.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's unfortunately, sometimes you have that many people together, they don't know how to act.
Yeah.
It is sad to see something like that happen. And you know, one of the things that I have, you know, been privy to over the years is kind of like how single-minded a lot of people are in the fighting game community, particularly when it comes to like longevity. Like, that's one of the reasons why I have to give Mike so much credit with trying to do the Super Arcade thing. I mean, a lot of people can say they're about this and then they're not about this. You know what I mean? Mike is not one of those people. But you know, you hear these people that are like, you know, the community, but they're the same ones that are super quick to steal something. As far as games go, you know, they're pretty much super quick to contribute to people not making the kind of stuff that they actually want to buy, because there's no money in it. So, I mean, there's that factor of it too. So it's just a little crazy. That's all.
Yeah. But it looks like Capcom has outlined their plans for the Street Fighter V beta.
Outlined and enacted some of them.
Yeah, the European one happened over the weekend.
Yep, so, and the Asian one is going on, I think, either right now or later on today. It'll have definitely happened. Before I say that, I better check on the particulars here. But it's already underway on the Asian region, according to Tomoaki Ayano. And then these don't count as the 5-day beta that they've been talking about. These are just stress tests for particular regions, so that when they do launch the 5-day the 5-day first wave test, it doesn't go the way it went last time they tried to launch it.
Yeah.
So,
any reports of things falling over so far?
You guys keep talking. I'll be right back.
All right.
Okay.
As I said, that any reports of the stuff falling over as of yet?
I haven't really heard anything one way or another. The last few days, I've kind of been more involved with local stuff.
Okay.
And really just, I just haven't been able to follow it. But it sounds like it must have gone off without a hitch if they're going ahead with the Asian test.
Yeah.
And then if that goes well, then I figure we're going to be next sometime in the next few days.
Yeah. Kind of leads us to Ono saying he's got stuff to say at PAX coming up.
He announced an announcement. Next week at PAX, they're going to have some kind of announcement. We can only assume it's character number 10. Whether it's going to be one of the four newcomers or one of the 12 returning characters, we have no idea yet. But that is what all signs point to, as far as the Capcom portion of PAX goes. And hopefully we'll get another wave of casual play streams again, because the last ones that we've seen, the ones out of the UK are now like a couple versions old. I mean, we haven't seen Nicali in these, we haven't seen Vega in these. So, hopefully we'll get to see a new build in action here pretty soon, and
get to play
PAX will be PAX will be a good time to debut that.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it. Hopefully, when we do get it, in March of 2016 or whenever the heck it comes out, we'll be able to put the disc in and install it and be able to immediately go online and not have, connection explode.
That's why they're doing this.
Yeah, they can do it, that's the thing. It's once you get everybody. You can do regional stress tests, okay, and kind of judge how much it's going to extrapolate to, but you really don't know once you get the entire world on the game at once.
Yeah. At that point, I think that's also the brilliance of tying the beta test to the pre-orders, because that should leave a good number of your pre-order a good number of your day one user base right there beating down on your servers, so you'll kind of know what to expect.
Yeah, that's a good point, actually.
They made it as open as possible, and, the more subjects, the better the test.
Yeah. Shall we wait and see? Okay, this next story is kind of cool. Probably, which should come as no surprise to anybody at this point, the Xbox One could potentially have backwards compatibility for the original Xbox.
I love everything about this.
Yeah, this came about as kind of a discussion on Twitter. Phil Spencer kind of mentioned, someone asked him on Twitter if this would ever be a possibility, and Phil Spencer was like, I bug the engineering team about this like every day. So, I considering the architecture of the Xbox One and the original Xbox, I almost said Xbox One. That would have been confusing.
All right, I'm back.
Welcome back. Yeah, considering the architecture of those two systems, I think it would probably actually be easier, and original Xbox games would probably run better on the Xbox One.
Yeah.
So, you know.
And even failing that, the Xbox One has got such advanced hardware at this point in comparison that it should be able to brute force it.
It should be able to, but it shouldn't need to.
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah. Yeah. Because under the hood, I mean, the original Xbox was still running an embedded version of Windows. So, it was using DirectX, all stuff that the Xbox One is using. The hardest, I'm not going to say this is a trivial thing to do, but they basically need to do, call translations from the old APIs to the new. And they should be able to get it going.
Nice.
Yeah.
Which means that I might have to feature some Project Gotham Racing 1 on my YouTube channel at some point.
Yes, PGR 1 was still good.
Yeah.
2 was actually, I liked 2. It got kind of a bad rap, but 2 was really good.
I still have mixed feelings about PGR 2.
Yeah. That begs the question, though.
A lot of it comes back to the frame rate.
Yeah, that was not good. If they're going to do PGR 2, though, I'm wondering how they're going to handle DLC, because I still have some old PGR 2 DLC on my Microsoft account that I can't access. Yeah. Very interesting to see what they do about that. Anyway.
Speaking of it in practical terms, I would say they either forget about it or re-release it.
Yeah.
I am just of the mindset that any of the DLC from the legacy Xbox was gone, any record of it was gone the moment they pulled the plug on the legacy servers, which would be a shame, but just looking at it realistically, there wasn't so much DLC going on back then that anyone was too heavily invested in it.
Yeah.
I think DDR players probably got the worst end of it.
Yeah.
But at the same time, for stuff like PGR 2, it might be worth making it available.
Yeah. Well, they might just, do something like, since they're going to have to download the entire game anyway, they could just, throw all the DLC in there. You put the disc in and it just gives you everything.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of having to...
some kind of Game of the Year edition.
Yeah. Well, instead of having to re-enable Xbox Live Legacy...
Yeah,
I could just say okay, we're not going to make any money on this DLC anyway. It's
I can hope.
We can hope. And finally, Nintendo files a patent for a diskless console. What it's looking like.
Yeah.
Yep.
Now, what are the particulars on this? Because you told me before the show that some people kind of got the wrong idea about it.
Yeah, well, some people are saying this is completely digital and it's going to be Nintendo screwing collectors and all that. But no, if you look at the patent drawing, there's a little image there that kind of shows the architecture. There's a memory card there.
Yeah.
So, they might do cartridges again at this point. Well,
the time's right.
Yeah. Technology-wise, you can put some NAND flash is very, very cheap. So, you can get that in there.
Yeah.
But, yeah, if you have that article up, look at that image. And just kind of go through the architecture and have a look at it. And then tell me if it reminds you of anything.
It kind of vaguely reminds me of the N64.
Yeah, on a generalized level, as far as the architecture goes, Nintendo is trying to patent a modern gaming console, which already exists.
I gotcha.
So, if Nintendo's business plan going forward is to become a patent troll...
Sue them all?
Yeah, it's... U.S. patent system is pretty broken at this point already, so if that's the route they're going, okay then.
This would almost be the Megaton as told by Spong.
Yeah. I'm really honestly surprised nobody has seen that.
Oh boy.
You replace memory card with, you know, optical drive, and that's the architecture of an Xbox One or PS4.
Yep.
So, yeah. Patent issues aside, though, what do you guys think of a cartridge-based Nintendo NX?
I think that's a logical place to go. I think we've spent the last 20 years or so looking at not only the benefits, but the detriments of moving parts in a game console. And if Nintendo's taking some initial steps to maybe move away from that, with flash memory or some kind of solid state memory, then I think that can only be a good thing from a consumer standpoint.
Mm-hmm.
I've long been an advocate of getting rid of all the moving parts.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, you were right. Technologically, now, it would actually be a lot easier and probably a little cheaper to just put some drives into a cartridge and then just send it out that way. I mean, that way you get rid of having to deal with a, you know, spinner and scratch discs and all that crap.
Yeah. You could do it with SD cards, or you could do, as Nintendo would probably end up doing, something proprietary. You bring back the Hue card, you got, you know, plenty of space there. Well, the Hue card itself didn't have a lot of space, but the form factor, you know, a credit card sized little thingy would probably be pretty cool. You know, I don't think they would end up using standard SD cards for a home system, because that's just too small.
What if it was the same interface as a 3DS game?
Well, that's about the same size as an SD card. I think it's a little too small for a home console.
Yeah.
You'd lose those pretty easily.
Yeah, if we
not,
had
not
like...
Not quite the point I was trying to make, but...
Yeah. Like, what would... like, if they were to go back to cartridges, what would a modern cartridge look like?
Well, could look like anything, really. I mean, basically, a cartridge is it's a printed circuit board with a bunch of connectors on the end of it that slaps into a slot.
Do you make it intentionally larger just for the sake of making it larger to not be lost, or...
Or would it just be a flash drive? I mean...
Yeah, I think you'd probably end up making it larger. I mean, I think the right size, if I had to guess, would be about the size of a Sega Genesis cartridge.
Okay.
Yeah.
You could convince me.
They were like
that.
Those were like about the Sega Genesis was like about half as big as a Super Nintendo cartridge was.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that'd work.
Yeah. Plus, you know, with today's technology, that gives you a lot of room for flash memory in there. I mean, something that small, that's about the size of a regular 2.5-inch solid state drive. So, you could end up with you have enough room in there for, say, like, you know, 4 terabytes or more of flash on there.
And they can just
do the game would be expensive as hell at that point.
Yeah, I don't think anybody's going to pay $250 to $300 for a game. So,
yeah.
I just think it would be really awkward to have, like, a Genesis-sized cartridge with maybe a quarter square inch of it actually being, of the innards actually being dedicated to the contents.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm thinking it's probably going to be something like a card style interface, just something about the size of a credit card or whatever, just slides into a slot.
Don't have to worry about any discs or any crap like that.
Yeah, yeah. On a technical level, I'm really interested in this. I'm hoping they actually, you know, go that way, because discs are dumb, especially when you have to install the game off of it anyway.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, we moved away from cartridges.
They're also cheap, though.
Yeah, they're cheap.
As a delivery mechanism, so. Plus, the other thing about that, too, is that if you were still going with disk-based stuff, that means the system also has potential to do other things with disks, such as play movies or music, which, of course, Nintendo's never given a shit about, but... Yeah. That is one of those things that it does seem in the console space that when people buy consoles, they expect them to do more than just play games.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I just think it's interesting that we moved away from cartridges when cartridges started becoming the bottleneck in delivering the best possible game experience, and now we're moving away from optical media to cartridges once they became the bottleneck.
Yeah, well, it's, it's, you know, it's always
ebb and flow.
Yeah. It's very circular. Technology just keeps on moving.
Like a disc.
Yeah. But you can scratch an SD card all you want, and it'll still work.
Yeah. You scratch the top of a disc, and it's dead.
Challenge accepted. I'll let you guys know what happens next week. I have a bunch sitting here on my desk.
What are you going to scratch it with, a belt sander?
Well, now.
I think we got a YouTube feature coming up.
Okay. The interesting part about that, though, is if they go that route, is that, you know, historically, whenever there are, you know, drops in what flash memory costs, that's never passed on to the customer. So I wouldn't expect to see it any different now. But like, I was on Amazon the other day and just was blown away by, I saw like a, I want to say it was 128 gig micro SD card. My God, like,
yeah,
you monsters,
yeah.
It's just crazy to me, the miniaturization of that kind of stuff, because, like, you know, you can look at like a 2.5 inch, you know, hard drive and go, holy crap, there's a terabyte in there, there's 2 terabytes in there, that's bananas. But then, like, to take it on a different level and be like, wow, you know, like, and I saw 256 gig SD card as well, like micro SD, like, that's insane to me.
Yeah,
like,
and then, wow. then you got Samsung going completely just bonkers with a 2.5 inch 15 millimeter form factor SAS drive with 16 terabytes. That's a crap ton of flash in a very small package.
Wasn't there something announced a few years ago where, like, they were going to be able to, like, increase the amount that could be stored on a Blu-ray disc by like 16, like by a factor of 16? Did anything ever come of that?
No, I think the most that they've managed to get up to at this point is 100 gig.
Yeah.
So they're going to be using that for the 4K Blu-ray that's coming out later this year.
That feels like such a completely worthless upgrade to me.
It is.
I know a lot of people are like, yeah, like, no. Mm-mm.
4K itself, you know, as far as resolution goes, okay, it's finer detail, whatever. That's not what's interesting me about it. What interests me more is the dynamic range. So you have a wider range of colors that you can, you know, reproduce on the screen at once, better light levels. It's, yeah, this is weird coming from the guy with the visual impairment, but surprisingly, I can actually tell a lot. I mean, if something looks really, really crappy, for me, it looks really crappy. So go figure.
Yeah, that's just one of those things where it feels like, I guess to me, like, you have this group of people that are, you know, obviously I'm never going to say we shouldn't push the envelope and try not to get, you know, technology and do, like, new stuff that's awesome. But at the same time, we have sort of like the physical industry dying as far as movies go and things like that, because people are okay with streaming quality, even though it's the fidelity of it is not nearly as large as what you would just get on a 1080p.
You lose a lot.
Yeah,
you lose a lot. And so it's fascinating for me to see that, like, again, like, it feels like the technology industries are sort of working completely against what the broadband industry, what their model is working on. Because, like, Netflix is like, yeah, we're going to have streaming 4K. So you mean I can hit my data cap in 2.5 hours? Like, it's the same kind of thing. Like all this technology and how well it gets implemented and how well it gets picked up is going to be completely based around whether or not the internet keeps up with everything.
Yeah. Have your ISP and, calling your house asking what on earth's going on over there.
Yeah. So it's crazy to me to even think that a lot of this stuff is coming out, because I think 1080p looks great. I'm just like you though, Phil. I want to see, you know, give me more detail. Cause I remember when HD came out, I drove my wife crazy because I was like, I was picking anything up on HD that we could get just to look at it. You know, like yeah. I remember like at one point we made the joke, like I would watch paint dry in HD, like just because I'm like, oh my God, look at the fidelity. You know? Whereas now, I think because we've had that jump, I'm just kind of like, all right, whatever. Hmm. And I don't think it matters to me as much. And in the same way that, like, if we take a look at, to go back to what we were talking about, like, remember we were talking about the original Zelda and then we were talking about Link to the Past? Mm-hmm. Like, the jump was tremendous. But, and then, you know, as we've had subsequent generations, that jump has sort of been less and less and less. Like, I went back, you know, when I finished Arkham Knight a couple of weeks ago. Arkham Knight looks fantastic. But it doesn't look that much better than Arkham City or anything else did. And, you know, that's because the sort of the return on that sort of technological investment, it decreases greatly. And so I think we're going to have the same kind of thing where you might have the public be like, you know what, I'm good.
Yeah.
Like, you know, it looks nice. Okay.
Yeah. I mean, I don't see 4K becoming mainstream not in the next, you know, 5 years at least.
Yeah.
You know, it's always that way. I mean, you always have the newest, highest fidelity disc format comes out and then, you know, people figure out how to stream it, and then, you know, it just keeps progressing from that. And as, you know, more and more bandwidth gets consumed, well, then the ISPs are having to have to reevaluate their, you know, policies because,
yeah.
If all of a sudden all of their customers are busting their caps, then it's like, well, we got to do something here because we got a lot of very unhappy customers.
And this is where we're thankful for net neutrality.
Yeah. Well, and Comcast, yeah, because Comcast doesn't give a shit if their customers are happy.
Yeah. Unless Google says they're about to roll out in their area, and then, oh, all of a sudden, things happen.
Yeah, that's why I was so happy to at least see, like, I think a lot of people, I know a lot of people that were like, I don't get what the big deal about net neutrality is, and I remember a friend of mine was like, well, Ted Cruz said it's the Obamacare of the internet, and I was like, that doesn't even make sense, but okay.
Yeah.
Like, and the people that were saying, like, to get rid of net neutrality meant that it would be better for, like, small businesses. And it was like, do you guys don't know how to read? Because that's so totally not how this would work.
It's the opposite of the truth.
That's the exact opposite of what would actually happen.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And, but yeah, like, the interesting part, though, is that what I read the other day was, since net neutrality is basically the law now, apparently people have been inundating the FCC with complaints about data caps.
Yeah.
So, and the thing is the data caps aren't illegal. So that's not really the issue. It's more along the lines of,
kind of like consumer.
Yeah, exactly. And so, yeah, it's going to be, that's the thing that's always killed me. Like when this generation came around and people were like, yeah, man, going all digital. I'm like, where do you live?
Yeah.
Because, like, I don't even put my PlayStation 4 on standby because it'll download a bunch of updates to, like, the shit that I've gotten off of a PSN, which, you know, you know, sometimes you just add them to add them.
Yeah.
And, I'll blow through my data cap between my wife doing her thing. It just doesn't end.
Yeah.
So I could never see doing, like an all digital future because there's no, that just would not work for what we have going on here.
Yeah. At least right
Google
now.
Fiber would have to be the norm everywhere.
Yeah.
Well, you know, the all digital could work. It's just, we'd have to, you know, completely change our entire economic system.
Yeah.
Well, then there's that.
Which is something, you know, I've, you know, kind of sort of been advocating, but that's for another cast.
Yeah. All right. Well, I think we're going to call it a day, I think. So
it's a pretty good day.
Yeah, pretty good day. I think we went a couple of hours. I don't know. I can't tell how much. I know it's still recording, but I don't know how long we've been recording. At any rate, I am...
About an hour.
Yeah, a little or more. At any rate, I'm Filippo D'Onofrio.
I'm Patrick Mifflin.
I'm Brandon Perkins.
And I'm Lee Lamb.
We'll catch you all next week.